We wouldn't be able to keep this archive going without your support. Donate online today at wyxr.org.
This is Yvonne Bobo from Off the Walls Arts, and you're listening to WYXR 91.7 FM Memphis.
This is the Daily Memphian Midday News Brief. A neighborhood market may soon replace the vacant Walgreens at the corner of Highland Street and Summer Avenue. Sophia Surrett says RAND management filed a major modification request with the Memphis and Shelby County Division of Planning and Development last Wednesday to build the market on the 1.88-acre site.
The project would involve renovating the closed Walgreens at 3502 Summer Avenue and converting it into a neighborhood market with nearly 60 parking spaces and a fueling station with a canopy. The renovation of the Walgreens would include removing the pharmacy's canopy and drive-up window. The market would have a local retail option and multiple kiosks offering goods and services to the community, such as a phone service vendor, utility, bill payment station, bakery, and coffee shop. For the Daily Memphian, I'm Sophia Surrett.
Last Wednesday, the University of Memphis dedicated the new $45 million Edwards Research and Innovation Center, a wing of classrooms and labs designed to bridge the job skills engineers will need this century. The wing includes labs for earthquake engineering, cybersecurity, advanced manufacturing, big data, AI, and robotics. The building was designed to serve students in arts and sciences and the Herf College of Engineering. But behind the scenes, its leaders are working against time and odds to improve enrollment. Between 2019 and 2023, the college lost 220 undergrads, nearly 20% of the enrollment, according to university records. For Jane Roberts, I'm Natalie Van Gundy. More on these stories and others are available at dailymemphian.com.
For a long time, many of those final years, my mom was sleeping on the couch in the living room, dad was in the bedroom. Like for a long time, we could sense as children and getting old as young men that they had fallen out of love, right, for a long time. But they remained together for a long time. I remember them arguing about money and those kinds of things. Right. They remained together for my brother and I. That was important to them. So by the time they were that my mom was ready to file for that divorce, my I understood. And so I think when my dad and mom came to us, my brother and I, and said, you know, we're going to be getting a divorce, I think they expected a different sort of response and reaction from us. But at that point, I think we understood. And what we told them was like, well, maybe this is best for both of you.
This is a journey.
Let me take you on a journey.
There will still be the
journey. The journey.
New sheriff in town. Name
it. The journey.
Journey.
This thing is bigger than Nino Brown. This is
the journey.
The journey.
What is it that moved you?
The Journey Memphis is being generously supported by Nike's Black Community Commitment and Methodist Laboner Healthcare. Welcome back to another episode of The Journey. I'm your host, Larry Robinson, and today I promise you we will not let you down as it relates to the great, great people that we have coming here before you. Before we get there, though, let's check out our quote of the show. It comes from the great novelist, writer, storyteller, James Baldwin, and it goes a little something like this. If you know whence you came, there is really no limit to where you can go. If you know where you came from, you can go as far as you need to go to be successful. Now to our guests. We have Jason Smith. He's a JK, what we call a journalist kid, sports fanatic, proud and committed father, as well as a definite, definite committed son. So without further ado, we have Brother Jason Smith. What's up, Jason?
What's up, Brother Robinson?
How you doing,
good,
man?
Good to be here, man.
Good,
I appreciate
man. We're glad to have you.
Dude, it's an absolute pleasure and an honor to be here with you.
Oh,
a man who's been a mentor for me and who's been a great deal to my career. So I'm coming here thanking you.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that.
Yeah,
well, this
no
is
smoke.
All about you, brother. This is your journey. So the first question I got for you, tell me about the house you were raised in. You know, what was the dynamic like?
Midtown Memphis. It was actually an apartment. Off of Stonewall and Poplar.
Wait a minute, that ain't where you. That ain't when you got to Memphis. You got to Memphis. You was from Florida.
Well, Fort Pierce, Florida, first grade, kindergarten, those kinds
okay,
of things.
Okay,
yeah,
well,
I mean, back
that,
then, back then, that was my father moving up the media ladder, and we were in Fort Pierce, Florida, for about a year.
Okay,
had moved there from Kansas City.
Okay,
so second grade, early '80s, about '83
okay.
was the time I got here. I guess about 6 years old, 5 years old. And
okay.
for the most of my upbringing, after
being around the beach for about a year down in Florida, was in Midtown Memphis. Ain't no water except Adventure River around. And so it was quite a, for a 5 or 6 year old, it was quite a change. But then, yeah, Midtown Memphis, apartment in Memphis as my dad was working his way up through local media.
Okay, and where'd you go to high school?
High school was White Station High School after Stone Junior High.
Oh, wow, yeah. Okay. So who outside of your parents had the most influence or impact on young Jason?
That's a great question. I would probably say my teachers.
Really?
You know, yeah, definitely. Because I'll tell you this, Larry, coming up in predominantly black Memphis as a mixed kid, black dad, but my mom was white.
Okay.
There was a lot of trying to figure out, okay, which side of the tracks do I belong to? And it was happening right here in Memphis where, again, my school when I first started out, predominantly black. Obviously, it was at Roswell Elementary before Snowden.
Right.
And so back to the point, you know, for me, finding out, you know, where do I belong, was a lot of my upbringing, and my teachers were absolutely vital in that.
Really?
Yeah, I think because they saw a young man struggling socially to find out what his click was. Hey, am I going to be with these white guys? Because my mom's white, I can relate to those guys.
Right.
Or am I going to be with these black guys that I look more like,
right,
that are actually relating to me, talking to me in a Memphis way that I hadn't heard before. but clearly they think I'm one of them. Back then, I mean, I had the nappy hair and everything. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't like your typical mixed kid who's got the straight leg stuff. They're saying you like one of us. And so, long story short, my teachers who saw a young man trying to figure it out came to me and said, "Man, stop trying to be one thing or other. Just be yourself." And I know that's cliche advice that a lot of us got from our grandmothers and parents and everything else, but it really was those teachers, you know, taking time to say, we see you struggling a little bit, just be yourself and stop worrying so much about where you belong.
Cool. Yeah. Who did you want to be as a kid, man?
I wanted to be an archaeologist, believe it or not. Man, must have been the white side in me, Larry. I wanted to be Indiana Jones
is what I wanted to be.
Yeah, Harrison Ford and the Indiana Jones movies had me want to go out, search for treasure, fossils, dinosaur bones, and all that. Growing up, I was dead set on being an archaeologist, and I decided that the University of Chicago, I had looked it up, had this great archaeology program that I was eventually going to go off into. And I tell you what, I held on to that dream probably until about middle of high school. I said, you know what, that ain't going to get me anywhere. You can't be a black Indiana Jones or a mixed one.
So what decision did you make as a young person that ended up having an impact on you and having a lifelong impact, but you didn't know it at the time?
That's a great question. I think it was realizing that I was a follower. Maybe for the reasons that we just talked about, always sort of searching for what my group was, but in that, realizing that, rather than leading and blazing my own path, I was looking for someone to lead me. And so whether it was, you know, and those are longer stories, but whether it was my failures or whatever else, eventually I realized I've got to lead my own path. Now it took me so much time to realize that you can't be a follower if you're gonna get to where you wanna go.
Was there a moment that you said, you know what, I can't do this?
Well, I'll be real honest with you. It was a moment, probably my lowest moment, where had an issue with drinking. And a lot of that was, again, socially. It's what my friends are doing and everything else.
Right.
Been drawn into that because everyone else was a lot like a follower mentality. And I'll be real honest with you. It's a story I've told in a testimony at church. A week before my son was born, I'm in the Shelby County Jail serving 48 hours for a DUI.
Mm.
And so even at that point in my life, now I'm in the workforce and everything else, I realized that because of that follower mentality that I had, you know, trying to find whatever it was, I'd put myself in a situation where I may very well miss the birth of my son. Now, God was good. I was able to do those 48 hours, get out a week later, my son's being born.
Right.
But similar to maybe some of the stories you've heard here on the journey, I told myself in that moment, no more. No more following, no more drinking in that instance, because it had put me in a place I didn't want to be, in a place that was potentially damaging to my family. And so it was that moment, I'll be real honest with you, Larry, where
with God's help, I decided, you know what, I'm no longer following, whether it's socially someone or trying to climb a ladder in terms of professionally.
Right.
I'm gonna follow God. And thank God, a then developing relationship that got stronger helped me kick the alcohol and go from following to, you know, more serving than anything else.
I got you. When did you know you were gonna be okay? At what point in your life did you say, you know what, I can do this thing called life?
It was after teaching Bible studies to a group of kids. I've never been more intimidated by a job, having no relationship with God coming up, but then trying to walk into a church. That was intimidating. Going into a black church those first few times, that was intimidating. You know, I've changed jobs, that's intimidating. But I've never been more intimidated than I was when my pastor asked me, when he thought I was ready, to lead a youth Bible study. Because while I did, Larry, have a great upbringing, two-parent household, right. I wasn't raised in a church, so I didn't have, and maybe this goes back to sort of that follower mentality, I didn't have a relationship, a foundation, a relationship with God. And so when I was able to talk to a bunch of even some even younger than that, 5 and 4 year olds, and talk about God in not having any relationship,
right,
but being put in that position, first thing I did was sweat, because what these kids are going to know the Bible better than me, all that.
Right.
What's God doing right here? Why am I the one that's in this position?
Right.
Never saw myself leading a Bible study. But it's funny, Larry, just in you asking that question, when I got done with the first one, I've never felt more fulfilled, whether it's professional life, socially, marrying my wife, everything else, than being in that spot, because God had taken literally a wretch, somebody who at one time was called an atheist when he was young.
Wow.
He was so, and it just didn't have any relationship whatsoever with God. God had taken me and, to me, shown me a miracle that, brother, you can do this.
Now, right.
You know what I'm saying? And not only can you, this is what I want you to be doing. So I knew I was all right once I was comfortable enough to talk about my faith, whether it was with, you know, my family or with a group of kids who were learning, because to me, that's the most important job. Like,
right,
if you can pour that sort of foundation and faith and support, a relationship with God, into a child,
right,
something I didn't have,
right,
brother, that's as good as it gets in terms of life achievement.
That's
so
powerful.
So that's when I knew I was okay, when I was teaching Bible studies and trying to spread God's love.
Okay. Last question of this segment. Every brother has a point where they realize they are a black man. What was that moment for you?
Probably early.
Hold on. Listen, we're going to be right back on the journey. My brother Jason is going to talk about the moment that he realized he was a brother. Stay right there. Be right back after this.
This is a journey.
Let me take you on a journey.
Success in life is not a straight line. There are twists and turns in everyone's life, and the more you know about their story, the more you'll understand the process. Kazukian Media Group proudly presents The Journey, a show that features successful black men in Memphis telling their stories of their lives and the ups and downs they've encountered on their ultimate road to success. We believe The Journey will encourage young men and help them see that life is a journey. Watch The Journey, hosted by me, Larry Robinson. Brought to you by the Kazukia Media Group in partnership with the Delta Boulay.
Welcome back to The Journey. I'm your host, Larry Robinson, and today we got an amazing guest, an amazing Memphis icon, Brother Jason Smith. So Jason, before we left, I ask you, what was that moment that you knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that you were a black man?
You know, my grandmother told me at a very young age that, and this is my paternal grandmother, my dad's mom, black woman, had been raised in Chicago, moved to Missouri, and she told me very early, before I even understood it, that because you have black blood in you, I want you to know, grandson, that you are black. And at the time, you know, in terms of the impact, I didn't really understand the conversation. Again, you're talking about a kid who's got a white mom, but is being told he's black. Didn't understand it, but she let me though there. You asked me though when I realized. It was in elementary school here in Memphis, Tennessee.
Okay.
Because again, once I was in school and at a predominantly black school, I had my peers, my fellow students, the black kids looking at me as if I was one of them. Okay. And so there was no longer any, okay, well, what are you? Mm-hmm. They thought, whether it was my hair or whatever else, and I had, like I said, I had regular curly hair like they did, they thought I was black rather than a mixed kid. And, right. and again, we had mixed kids in our class right. that had straighter hair. And those kids would make fun of. When I got there, though, again, they thought I was a light-skinned black kid. Uh-huh. And so once they started, and I'll be real honest with you, my mother knew not the first thing about taking care of black hair. Which is what I had. My dad was too busy working to right. worry about taking care of his black sons. And so when my nappy small little afro in elementary uh-huh. school was getting checked left and right, that's when I knew, bro, I got black hair, I'm uh-huh. black. You okay. know what I'm saying? These folks have accepted me as one of them, and they let me know I need to do something with my hair. So I you know, with all due respect and love to my white mother, who uh-huh. to the, you know, 73 years old, still alive, and God bless her, everything she tried to do with my hair, it was then when I realized I got black hair that uh-huh. I need to get into somebody's barbershop and get chopped up. When I realized, you know what, this is how I'm going to be identified the rest of my life by others. Right. And frankly, it's how I feel the most comfortable identifying. And so that was when it was those school years where they told me, bro, you black and you need to get to a barbershop.
Wow. All right. So let's talk about the early years of the household. Siblings, mother, father. What does it look like?
Mother, father, both in the household. Like I said, black father in Memphis media, white mother who was working, basically a housewife until later on. Mm-hmm. We were again, small apartment, midtown Memphis, had a younger brother and it was just us. Okay. My dad had been one of five brothers who had moved out, had ventured out of this small town called Fulton, Missouri. Okay. After growing up in Chicago, they had moved to Missouri.
Okay.
These five brothers and their mom, and all of them stay. There's a small town of 11,000, about 30 miles or so from Columbia, where the University of Missouri is. They all were raised there, mm-hmm. but my dad was the one who left and got out. And that's, you know, actually started in country music radio, black man country music radio, if you can believe it.
Really?
Or not. Yeah, him and Charlie Pride. There weren't many of them back then. And he was a black disc jockey doing country music radio. It was his start, but he comes up, works his way into television, those kinds of things. And so anyway, we moved to Memphis, mm-hmm. early 80s. And he's moved away from his Missouri family. We mentioned we moved down to Florida for a year, then found a home in Memphis in the early 80s, and it was just us, just the four of us, mom, dad, and my brother Jeff, who was a year and a half younger than I am, growing up again in midtown Memphis, and a lot of it just kind of, wow, this new place and in the South, and just trying to feel our way through. So that was it. I mean, growing up in midtown, there, went to Snowden Junior High, and then on to White Station. A pretty normal childhood and upbringing mm-hmm. that included white friends, black friends, a little bit of everything.
So now your dad's wife of today is that your mom?
No.
Okay.
Now he got remarried later on in life. I guess I was in my late teens when my mom and dad divorced after 22 years.
So what kind of impact
did
that have on a young Jason?
I thought that marriage wasn't going to last. I thought that marriage couldn't last, that it didn't last, that if two people after 22 years had decided after all that time, right, that they were going to get a divorce, that the likelihood was, why would I get married? Because of what in 20 or 30 years, we haven't made it work to a point where I'm getting a divorce. No, it had a huge impact. Even though my mom and dad stayed together long enough for my brother and I to get to an age where we understood.
Right.
For a long time, many of those final years, my mom was sleeping on the couch in the living room, dad was in the bedroom. Like for a long time, we could sense as children and getting old as young men that they had fallen out of love, right, for a long time. But they remained together for a long time. I remember them arguing about money and those kinds of things. Right. They remained together for my brother and I. That was important to them. So by the time my mom was ready to file for that divorce, I understood. And so I think when my dad and mom came to us, my brother and I, and said, you know, we're going to be getting a divorce, I think they expected a different sort of response and reaction from us. Uh-huh. But at that point, I think we understood. And what we told them was like, well, maybe this is best for both of you. It was sort of, we had reached a point in our lives where we were able to understand it in that way. Okay. And you know what, to be out of love that long, that's a hard life that you live. That's that I think about my wife.
They loved you guys and wanted to create an environment.
100%. And so in the end, I couldn't do anything but, you know, the fact that couldn't do anything but salute them and thank them that they had done that for us, because we were old enough to understand. It really was, it could have been so much more detrimental in terms of what I might have gone through as a kid, or the way I'd looked at things if it had happened earlier on in my life. But we understood it well enough, and later on I was able to put down, well, you know, what happened to my mom and dad, and what happened to, you know, the moms and dads of a lot of my friends who had were being raised by one, you know, one parent or the other, to realize, you know, that doesn't necessarily have to be the case for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Young man, Midtown Memphis. Tell me about a fond memory of being raised in Midtown.
Wow, we had a, what was so crazy about Midtown was that to the left of us, if you went further down Stonewall, there were much nicer houses. We were in an apartment at Poplar and Stonewall. Almadura's there, which are a nice set of apartments. We were a little bit further down in some cheaper apartments. But if you went right across Poplar, you could throw a rock to the nicer houses, right? If you kept on walking down Stonewall, you'd be in North Memphis, okay, where everything, you know, doesn't look the same as it did between Stonewall and between Poplar and North Parkway. Right. And so I say that to say, and even behind our apartment, behind Stonewall, there was a huge, rich Vietnamese population in Midtown behind us. And so we had Vietnamese friends coming up in Midtown. And that was my fondest memory, is that being in Midtown, I was exposed to all kinds of different cultures. And maybe that's why I was running around so much, trying to figure out, okay, which one of them am I? Which one am I going to relate to the most? Which group do I fall in? Because we literally had everything, and we had it at our apartment. All my friends would come over to our apartment in Midtown. And I think that was my fondest memory of Midtown Memphis, was that it was a melting pot, much like we talk about this country. Right. Midtown is that. Now, it's changed quite a bit than it was, you know, back in those early 80s and 90s when I was coming through there. But one thing that's still the same is you will see everything.
Everybody.
You will see all walks.
That's what
in
I
Midtown,
love about
Memphis.
Living in Midtown.
100%.
It's everything, yeah.
It's everything, and it's right there for you. And so we were exposed to so much, and it was great for me, because whether it was, again, relating to somebody that I don't share the same culture with or whatever else, it just exposed me to a lot that I felt like was beneficial. I realized later on in my life, super beneficial in terms of relationships with folks, being able to get along with you know, folks that I may not stay or have preconceived notions about. That was the best thing about growing in Midtown, is, man, it was all there for you. You had friends everywhere.
Now I realize that, you know, maybe the DUI was a horrible thing in your life, but I want to go back to childhood. What was one of those not so fond memories? You know, one of those memories of a fight or something that you like, man, that was a ugly, horrible day.
I struggled with, I told you about the hair, and there, you know, I got some rough comments about, you know, before I finally got a fade, high top fade, got some, and I remember coming to school that day after I got my first real haircut, black haircut, got the high top fade, and it was like I was in, it was like it was slow motion walking down the hall, all the girls was turning and all that. I had finally found myself.
That sounded like a fond memory to me.
That was fond, and that's where I was going. At this same school, though, at Snowden, I used to have a huge, and still do struggle with it at times, but now that I'm in radio, it doesn't matter. I had a huge acne issue, zits, man. They used to call me pizza face in middle school coming up. And so I was so, man, just so self-conscious about it. I don't know what it was, just had real sensitive skin. And back then, it razor bumps, all that stuff, but just real sensitive skin. You know, kids with acne, man, they go through all kinds of stuff, but it was there where, whether it was me being talked about, whatever else, I got into a fight over it with a brother named Quintus Bishop, who went on to become a pretty good football player at Snowden and then over at Central High School. Quintus had called me pizza face. So I was done, Larry. I'm going to fight for the first time over at Snowden at what, I guess this was a seventh grader. Man, yeah, I took the L. I'd won my, I'd gone into that thing saying I'm going to put my dukes up, and Quintus Bishop, I've told this story before, taught me about Memphis City School fight, is that Your square tail might think you come in here and you're going to put your dukes up, but you realize that there are no rules in Memphis City School fights. And so as soon as I put my dukes up, Quintus was kicking me, grabbing me, and everything else. And I realized, man, ain't no rules to this in fight. This man is from North Memphis. And so, yeah, in front of just about everybody in our PE class, man, I got embarrassed. And I probably, like I said, I needed it.
How did you handle the next day?
Oh, it was rough. I think I got my dad to call in the school for me and tell him I had a stomach ache. I think I remember not going to school the next day because of that fight. Yeah, I took that one. And I'll tell you what, I was involved in very few fights after that because I realized, bro, you ain't
cut out for that.
And it ain't just going to be boxing, man. We're talking about fighting in Memphis City School. So that was probably one of the low points. That and, man, getting jumped at White Station as a senior by a bunch of freshmen.
You got jumped?
In an intramural basketball game, man.
Oh, wow. By a bunch of freshmen.
Now, I got one of them. But only one.
But only
the one that fell on the ground. I was stomping, and the rest of them were... Yeah, man, got an intramural basketball, White Station, and they called the game after I fouled a guy hard. Uh-huh. Terry Tippett, the coach, longtime coach, and guy, right. Called the game, so we're not having any fighting. So the team that's up, y'all win. We were the team that was up.
Okay.
I'm walking off. I go to my my little girlfriend to get my chain back. As soon as I grab my chain, man, I'm getting beat over the head by these ninth graders from Magnolia Heights.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and one of them had fallen, and I said, man, if these folks whoop me blind, I'm still going to get this one. Basically losing fights in school in Memphis were some of my low points there. Since you want to bring me on down there and take me back there.
Well, no, it's for the kids, man. The kids need to know that you wasn't 10-0.
Well, just know that you're exactly. Just know that you can come out 0-2 and still be okay. You can come out having lost all your fights and still be okay in life. You ain't gotta don't have to focus so much on winning all of them.
What was it like to transition to adulthood, man? You went to college. Tennessee State,
94, coming out of White Station.
So you went to Tennessee State, and how was that experience?
It was an educational experience in the sense of much more than books. It was not understanding, you know, sort of how blessed and lucky I was. Had earned a presidential scholarship out of White Station. Mm-hmm. I was rooming with my best friend, Toby, who was in the band up there at TSU.
Right.
He's my best friend, even despite the fact that people tell me, the old college things, you don't go to, don't be roommates with your best friend.
Right.
We weren't worried about that. I didn't apply anywhere else to school once Tennessee State had sent that letter. Wasn't concerned at all. And I said, well, this is going to make mom and dad happy. So what do I need to apply anywhere else for?
Right.
Get up there and a story I've told many times, you know, had blown that scholarship after the first semester.
Wait a minute. You went to Tennessee State.
94.
And you... We're out of there in one semester?
Out of there in one semester.
What did you do?
Stopped going to class. You know, I think you had to maintain a 2.0, and I had stopped going to class, got up there, and got turned out, like I've said, by those majorettes, the historically black band, just being in the hole.
You went up there and partied.
I went up there and partied. And I had been so square coming out of White Station that I had no idea that something like that might happen. But you hear all the tales now. You know, the guys that...
Right.
Or get that little taste of freedom.
Right.
Some of them wild out and lose it. And that was the thing about Tennessee State was the thing that the girls make it, but the guys come up there and get a little bit of freedom and don't. Now, in defense of Tennessee State, many of my friends, several of them, and I still shake their hands to this day, finished up there at Tennessee. Did Tennessee State didn't need to leave? Did just fine 4 years. So that old, you know.
So wait a minute, they didn't put you on probation or anything? They just sent you home.
Well, no. The school put me on probation for the second semester, and instead of my mom and dad paying for it, they said, "Nah, son, you're gonna come home." Frankly, you know, they let me know they had not set any money to the side. I hadn't planned on it. It was an academic scholarship, and they had planned on me being done in 4 years.
Right.
They didn't have any money, but more importantly, their point was, well, no, you're gonna learn the hard way. You're gonna come back home. After that winter of 1994,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to find a job and you'll figure it out from there. But at this point, if you're going to be in our house, which I still needed to be, obviously, at that point in my life, you're going to have to find a job or be in school. And so at that point, chose odd jobs, trying to figure it out. It took me about 5 years of framing houses, security guard, tried to find, you know, what am I going to do? And that's when I realized I don't need a job. That's not me. Look at these soft hands. I can't be a construction. Let me try to go get a profession. And went back in 1999,
So almost 5 years after I had screwed up at TSU, I'm back in college at the University of Memphis in the fall of 1999.
Have any problems that once you went back?
No problems at all. I was able to cruise through. I mean, I was a, I was an older student at that point, much more mature, wiser at that point. So I was able to cruise through in 3 years, come out in 2002, and then thankfully in 2003, a year later, the Commercial Appeal came and hired me as a sports writer. And my sort of professional career started from there. So,
wait a minute. You followed right in your dad's footsteps.
Yeah.
Did you know you were going to follow in your dad's footsteps?
I had intended when I went back to school in 1999 over at Memphis to go into television like dad.
Okay.
That was my plan. But I met a guy, you've heard me tell the story of Jerome Wright. He's a great, great Memphis.
Shout out to Jerome.
Former Neighbors editor, former editor of the Commercial Appeal.
Uh-huh.
He was teaching a media writing class over at the University of Memphis.
Okay.
And basically convinced me that you will be better as a storyteller in newspapers and print media rather than television media. And I bought it hook, line, and sinker because his point was, well, with television, you have such little time to tell your story.
Right.
Come with me. Come to newspapers, and you can tell your stories in a much longer and more explorative fashion.
Right.
And he was right when I first got there.
Okay.
But little did we know at that time, what was it, 2000 or so, that the newspaper business was about to undergo some great change, layoffs, the entire business changed.
Yeah,
and so when I got in 2003, it was one thing. We had a sports department that was robust with writers. We had double-digit writers up there.
Right.
By the time I moved on, dude, I had seen guys around me get laid off. We had a sports department more of about four or five. You know the deal. Immediately, everything's downsized. Advertising is now, how can we get it on the internet as opposed to in a print edition?
Right.
The paper even got physically smaller.
Right.
But that said, because I know that that's the path I needed to go. I thank Jerome to this day for talking me into that print, part of my career.
Now we're coming to the end of this, but I want to ask you. You're walking in the door. I want you to envision this. You're walking in the door of the house in Midtown that you were raised. Sitting at the table eating a bowl of cereal is young Jason Smith. What would you say to that kid?
I would say stop worrying about who you are, and I'll be real honest with you, Larry. I would take that kid by the hand and I'd take him to church. Again, there are times where I've resented my mom and dad for not giving me that foundation, because there have been so many times in my life where I've been looking, and I felt like now, if I had just had more of a relationship with God, what I'm trying to instill in my son now at a very young age, that so many of those questions that I was asking myself, so much of that worrying and anxiety would have been gone. And so if I'm talking to that Jason at the table, I would tell him, man, through whatever means necessary, if it's me having to take you there, and I know it's tough because you don't have parents that are taking you, get a relationship with God, with a higher power, because it can be a support system.
Right.
It can be a miracle worker for you if you believe enough.
Right.
And I didn't get that until so much later. So if little Jason had it earlier, I just felt there, a lot of the worrying, the crying about what do I, which group I join, what about my hair? I just feel like, does it go all the way? No, but I'm better able to deal with it. So I would tell that little guy, man, whatever you got to do, man, just try to get closer to God,
fantastic,
get that relationship.
Okay, well, we're at the end. And there's going to be all kind of boys, young people, checking out this show, this one right here, your episode. I would like you to look in that camera and leave them, those that are listening and watching, with a Jason Smithism.
I would say this, young folks, don't let those crabs pull you back down in the barrel. When you know what you want to do, go do it. But what's going to happen when you do that is you're going to have friends, you're going to have acquaintances that see you find your passion, see you on a path, and they're going to try to pull you off. They're going to tell you ain't good enough. They're going to tell you, no, you're doing the wrong thing. Do not listen to those crabs in that barrel trying to pull you back down. Keep climbing up that barrel, because too many times, Larry, especially in Memphis, Tennessee, we let those crabs pull us back down
and it keeps us from reaching our fullest potential. We listen to them, we start believing we're not good enough, we start believing maybe this is the wrong choice. You know, find that passion, find that purpose, and crawl out of that barrel. Don't let them crabs pull you back down in it. Because in Memphis, I guarantee you, they will try to do so. Don't let them.
If you know whence you've came, there is really no limit to where you can go. That's James yes, Baldwin, and that's how we started it out. Beautiful. And it sounds like, brother, you have figured out from who you are and from whence you've come.
Took a long time, Larry, and it took having guys like you in my life, for God putting gentlemen like you in my life for me to get there. So I appreciate you as well, and man, appreciate you for having me.
And what an honor. Brother, thank you.
Mine, brother.
Thank you.
Real
thank
talk.
You so much.
Yep.
Listen, this is the journey. I told you, we're going to keep bringing them. You just got to keep showing up as well. Till the next time, I'm Larry Robinson. For our guest, Jason Smith, peace.
Thank you to our partners at Nike's Black Community Commitment and Methodist Laboner Healthcare. To hear more incredible stories like this, be sure to download the Kudzukian app from the App Store or Google Play, or check out the Journey Memphis podcast on all your major podcast providers. Also, check us out on the Kudzukian Network.
Music Export Memphis presents the Tambourine Bash Thursday, October 10th at the historic Overton Park Shell. This annual celebration of collaboration is a one-of-a-kind night of Memphis music, featuring more than 30 musicians in collaborative sets, including headliner Southern Avenue with surprise guest collaborator. It all culminates in a finale super jam produced by Royal Studios' Boo Mitchell. Proceeds power Music Export Memphis's grant programs for Memphis musicians. Ticket information and event details can be found at musicexportmemphis.org.
Support for WYXR comes from Team Clean. With more than 22 years of experience, Team Clean provides services for home, work, or studio space. Biodegradable cleaning products mixed with common sense and tailored to each client's needs. Estimates and information at weareteamclean.com.
Programming on WYXR is brought to you by a grant from Arts Memphis, who has been working behind the scenes for 60 years to grow the foundation of Memphis arts.
Located on the second floor of the Crosstown Concourse, the Memphis Listening Lab is a curated collection of music and music history that is open to the public 6 days a week. Vinyl Happy Hour happens every Friday between 3 and 5 p.m., where guest DJs from around the community will spin some of their favorite records. More information and a complete listing of upcoming events at memphislisteninglab.org.
When I got pulled over, when my wife and I were heading to the hospital, she was in labor, right? Got stopped by the cops. I asked him to escort us to the hospital. He gave us a big fuss. Before I knew it, I was in the back of a police car, right? And my wife, and I, that's when I had to learn. I mean, that talk about perspective, right?
Right.
I had to calm down. I was so angry. I was ready to kick the windows out of the police car. I was so angry, right? But I was like, I've got to find the inner strength to be there when this child is born.
Right.
I've got to calm down.
This is a journey.
Let me take you on a journey.
There will still be
the journey.
The journey.
New sheriff in town, and his name is
the journey.
Journey.
This thing is bigger than Nino Brown. This is
the journey.
The journey.
What is it that moved you?
The journey.
The Journey Memphis is being generously supported by Nike's Black Community Commitment and Methodist Laboner Healthcare. Welcome back to another episode of The Journey. I'm your host, Larry Robinson, and today we have a Memphis icon that really has had an impact on this community. But the impact that he's going to have is going to be for generations to come. But before we go there, I got a quote from the great Jackie Robinson, the great baseball player, broke the color line. You know that guy, right? Well, listen, he says something like this. A life is not important except in the impact it has on other lives. What does that mean? That means to me that my life is not that important unless I can reach down and grab somebody else, help somebody, open a door for someone else. Today's Memphis icon has opened doors for many, and his impact will be felt for generations to come. Straight out of South Memphis, Morehouse Man,
I like to call him a technology evangelist. He's a great friend, a tremendous husband, and a phenomenal father. Please, no further ado, we have Mr. Maker Agwekwe. How are you, sir?
Doing well, thank you so much.
Good seeing you, man. Great I'm so happy you too, here, man. I ain't lying. This has been a long time coming.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm honored to be here, man. I know we would try to make it work, and I'm glad we reconnected to make this happen.
Fantastic, fantastic. South Memphis, bring us back. South Memphis.
Sure.
Young Maker. Tell me about Young Maker. Quick though, just tell me about Young Maker.
Well, you know, I was a good kid, you know, okay. for the most part. My father wasn't there, but my mother raised my brother and I in the same house with my grandmother and my great-grandmother. And so each one of them gave me life lessons. You know, my mother valued education so centrally. My grandmother brought my brother and I
so
kicking and screaming to
three
church.
Three generations of the females in your household.
That's right. That's right. And my great grandmother, who was born in 1900, she would babysit my brother and I when we were young, and there was always someone at home when we walked home from school.
Oh, so, amazing!
And so this is growing up in Castalia, South Memphis,
right,
was a challenged neighborhood then, like it's a challenged neighborhood now, right? And we saw a lot of things we probably shouldn't have seen, but at the same time, we came from a great loving household in the middle of that, and we're blessed to come out with successful careers.
Who outside of that household had the biggest impact on Young Maker?
Who outside of the household?
Outside of the household.
I don't know if I would say it's one person. I would definitely credit my church.
Really?
Castalia Baptist Church, absolutely.
From
the pastor to all the deacons. Like I said, my father wasn't there when I was growing up. I didn't meet him until I was 23. But all the examples I got about fatherhood and seeing what it means to be a father and be active as a dad.
Right.
I learned those foundationally in church.
Awesome.
So I credit that experience, and I'm glad my grandmother brought my brother and I kicking and screaming. church,
All of us is kicking and screaming going to church.
Yeah.
Decisions. What decision did you make as a young person that you can look back on and say, man, I didn't know it was going to have that kind of impact on my life, but it did?
Man, as a young person, how young?
As young as you want. You know?
I'm glad that I asked my mother when I was 10 years old for a Texas Instruments home computer for Christmas, and she made that happen for me. And
how old were you?
I was 10 years old.
Yeah. You 10 years old.
And I just got it because I wanted to play games on it, right?
Right.
But back then in 1983 and 84, right, you plugged it into the television at home, right? And it wasn't connected to the internet.
Right. Right.
And so, there was no like getting more games,
right?
Right? My allowance wasn't growing fast enough to get more games quick,
right.
So I got bored with it, but it came with a book on how to program in a language called BASIC.
Okay.
And I learned how to make my name move across the screen. Now imagine my name, Maker Agwekwe. You never saw it on television.
Right.
It was not a name you saw on television.
Absolutely.
Right? But my computer's plugged into the TV, right? So I made my name show up on the TV and move across the screen. I said, Mom,
that's cool, man.
My name is on TV.
Right.
And I've been coding, programming, I've been a software developer ever since. Yeah, absolutely.
Man, just that one Christmas gift.
Exactly. And I'm thankful to my mother for making it happen because she didn't have to, right?
The fact that you asked for it, though.
And she supported.
Right,
right. So my mother set really the example in terms of parenting that I wanted to follow with my own kids, right? It is, supporting your kids. And I can't say I was nearly even half as good as my mother was in that regard.
How different are you from the person you dreamed you'd be? young man sitting in bed, thinking about what he's going to grow up to be. How different are you from that person?
Man, before I got that home computer, I just knew I was going to be a pilot in the Air Force. That's what I...
A pilot in the Air Force?
Yeah, I used to have little model planes that, I would take old paper towel rolls,
right,
and so forth, and turn and attach things through them and make those into airplanes. Right.
Wow.
I was really interested in flying.
So you strike me as the kid that was in school that messed up the curve every time because he would get straight A's. Was that you, Mac?
In elementary school, I was mostly a straight A student. I will admit.
You know, but again, my mother, you know, she valued education so much, and she spent time with me with reading and math at home a lot, right? Even though she had one of those weird schedules, she worked for Ralston Purina at the time, and they had rotating shift, so she wasn't always, every 3 weeks she would change her shift.
Right.
Sometimes it'd be daytime, sometimes it'd be night, it'd be any one of these three shifts, and so, so I didn't, you know, so she wasn't always there, but when she was there, she made sure that that was something we did, right? So yeah, when the expectation, when we got to school, my brother and I was to make good grades. And
when
so,
did you know you was going to be okay? When did you know as a person, I can do this thing called life?
When did I know I can do this thing called life?
Yeah, when did you know you was going to be a success?
You know, you know, that's a great question. I mean, be honest, I never thought anything other than that, right?
Wow.
That, you know, and it was interesting because I didn't exactly see a lot of examples of what I was aspiring to be.
Right.
There wasn't a lot of black men being as pilots, right?
Right.
Wasn't a lot of, no black men in coding and software development, right? But I don't know, I was just too ignorant to realize that was a barrier, right?
Okay.
I just decided that this is what I wanted to do, and my mother instilled in me. She said, "You can do anything you set your mind to." Right?
Okay.
She would say that every parent says that to the kids, and I just believed it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I was a couple of other incidents that I realized that you know the rules were different for me as a black kid than they were for others. Right.
Well, hold on for a quick second.
Sure.
You mentioned being a black kid.
Mm-hmm.
When did you realize? You personally realized that you was a black man or someone different than the norm per se?
Yeah. I mean, I there were two instances that come to mind, right?
Okay, hold on, hold that thought.
All right,
we're gonna be right back on the journey where Brother Maker is going to share with us when he realized he's a little different. Stay right there. We're gonna be right back on the journey on the Kazukian Network.
This is a journey.
Let me take you on a journey.
Success in life is not a straight line. There are twists and turns in everyone's life, and the more you know about their story, the more you'll understand the process. Kazukian Media Group proudly presents The Journey, a show that features successful black men in Memphis telling their stories of their lives and the ups and downs they've encountered on their ultimate road to success. We believe The Journey will encourage young men and help them see that life is a journey. Watch The Journey, hosted by me, Larry Robinson. Brought to you by the Kazukian Media Group in partnership with the Delta Boule.
Welcome back to The Journey. I'm your host, Larry Robinson. And I told you, we was going to have an amazing Memphis icon today. Once again, we have Brother Maker Agwekwe, Code Crew. He's done a lot in this community, but this segment, you're going to learn all about it. So here we go. First thing, Maker, what's your why? Why you get up every day and fight this good fight?
You know, you're asking some great questions. I mean, for me, my why is, it is, you know, someone said, well, I can't say someone said, I mean, the Lord said.
That
you know, love God with all thy heart, soul, and mind. Love thy neighbor as thyself, right? All the law and the prophets hang on that. They all depend on that, right? So so that church upbringing is a big part of why, right? But, you know, I believe I found my calling, right? That every child in every school in every grade should have access to quality computer science education, right? That everybody should have that same opportunity to participate in the 21st century as a producer, if they have the aptitude and the interest to do so, right?
Wow.
And so it took me a long time. You know, I spent 19 years as a software developer, but I was still active.
Okay,
with
hold on. Don't go into the story yet. We're going to get to the story now. Just stay right there.
Right on.
So let's go back. You said you had a moment when you realized you was a black man or you was a black kid.
Yeah.
Tell us about that moment.
So two moments come to mind.
Okay.
So the first was when I was in second grade. I was in the Cub Scouts. My church had a Cub Scout troop, right?
Okay.
And so you know, every year they would have like Soapbox Derby, I think it was called,
right?
Where you make these
cars
and
wood and whatnot,
But we
didn't do it because we didn't have the money to do it, right? Oh. Our troop didn't have the money, right? And then, you know, but all the white troops would have that, right? And so, I kind of noticed that there was different experience, at least, from then, right? But then, but in terms of like being a black male in particular,
right?
I remember there was a Sears outlet in Whitehaven that my mother and my grandmother liked to go to and do some shopping, right? And I hated shopping, right? But I went.
You was on your way to being a man.
I guess so, right? Because I still hate shopping, right?
I still hate shopping to this day. Yeah. Go ahead, man.
But for some reason, I think I was returning a shirt.
Okay.
Or exchanging a shirt, right? So my mother and my brother sat in the car. I went inside, and then I came out. And as I was walking out, there were two older white ladies walking out ahead of me, right?
Okay.
And I was just walking back to the car, but they kept pausing and looking back, and then they would walk some, and pausing and looking back, and would walk some, and finally they just stopped and asked me to pass them, right? And I didn't think a whole lot of it, right? I said, excuse me, ladies, and I just kept walking, right?
Right.
But my mother from the car watched the whole thing, right? Mm. And she asked me what they said to me, and I told her what happened. And she explained to me that they were nervous that this young black male was following them out of the store. And that didn't even occur to me, right? But that's when I started to realize
that. What impact did that have on young Megan?
I just started to realize, even it started to further crystallize that the rules were different, right? That the experience that I have is going to be different from others, right? Mm-hmm. And that's carried forward to this day, right? I mean, lots of instances, right? When I think about all that, some of my white friends are surprised to learn that I've been stopped by the police more than 50 times. And
that's not hard to believe. I don't know why they have a problem believing that.
Right.
As many black young men that are killed,
right,
they act like this is something new.
Right. Right. But that's common. Right.
Right.
You know, I'm thankful that nothing's ever happened to me.
Right.
Some of my friends, I was never made to lay down on the ground with guns. You know, like some of my friends, like my brother, even. Mm-hmm. Right. But still, you know, stopped so many times. Now, granted, I would, as a young man driving a car, I probably did my fair share of speeding.
Right. Right.
So I probably deserve to be pulled over a few times. But I got stopped for walking in my neighborhood. Right. You know, I got when my wife was, you know, about how to give birth to my second child, we got stopped.
How is that for you? What does that do for your drive?
Yeah.
Or what does it do for you internally?
You know, it's difficult, right? Because you know, again, trying to learn the art of forgiveness and learning the art of perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
And trying to, you know, because as a young man, to be honest, sometimes I'm amazed that I'm still alive because some of the things I would mouth off back at police, right, that I really shouldn't have said, right?
Right.
But I was so angry, right?
Right.
You know, just dealing with some of the things, being left on the curb when the cops towed my car away,
right?
Claiming I stole my license plate things like that, right? And I was very angry when I got pulled over, when my wife and I were heading to the hospital. She was in labor, right? Got stopped by the cops. I asked him to escort us to the hospital. He gave us a big fuss. Before I knew it, I was in the back of a police car, right? And my wife, that's when I had to learn. I mean, talk about perspective, right?
Right.
I had to calm down. I was so angry. I was ready to kick the windows out of the police car. I was so angry, right? But I was like, I've got to find the inner strength to be there when this child is born.
Right.
I've got to calm down.
So many of us have been in that situation.
Yeah.
What did you do? What did you call on to get you to ratchet it down? Because you made it to the hospital, obviously.
I did. Yeah, I did.
So what did you call on? What was it in you that you were able to say, wait, I'm way out of line here. Let me ratchet this back.
Yeah. You know, I'm rooted in faith. I'm not really religious, you know what I'm saying, but I thought about that upbringing, right? They didn't cuff me at least, so I could at least pull my cell phone out of my pocket, and I called a friend of mine from the backseat of a police car, and she let me vent into her ear
how angry I was, right? Mm. And she helped talk me down, right? Mm. As to you know, that
you remember the friend?
Yeah, Gwen Jeffries is
right, my shout friend. Shout out to Miss Jeffries.
And my that daughter that was born later on that night, her middle name is Gwendolyn, right?
Oh, that's beautiful.
And you know, that's a long story too.
That night will live on.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's a part of Gwendolyn's
story. She calls her baby G. Calls my daughter baby G. Now she's in college. That girl
is. She ain't a baby no more.
No.
So listen, let's get back to this. So
sure.
Back Castalia, tell us when you had your most amazing memory. Outside of you getting that computer at Christmas, mm-hmm. Tell us about an amazing memory you had as a child in Castalia.
An amazing memory I had as a child in Castalia.
Mm-hmm.
Positive?
Positive, absolutely. One of them moments like, you know, Christmas or Thanksgiving or, you know, maybe it was a family time.
Yeah. You know, Castalia had its challenges, right?
Okay.
But you know, kids went outside to play, right?
Yeah.
So it's hard to me even tie down to a single moment. It's like going outside to play, right, with no agenda, but just have a good time, right?
Okay.
We used to play football in the street,
right?
Or we would get a milk crate and put it on
a telephone pole
and play basketball with a volleyball because we didn't have a.
We was innovative. We were innovative, buddy.
Right. And if we didn't have a volleyball, we would use a tennis ball to play basketball, which was crazy, right?
Yep.
But I value that experience, you know, so much in terms of just learning relationships and. Leadership, right,
mm-hmm.
and teamwork and cooperation in ways that more suburban families got in different ways, right? And so I don't know if I can tie it to a moment necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like I say, there were a lot of moments of things happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I grew up in Castalia Baptist Church too, so which was in the same neighborhood, and Magnolia Elementary School, right? Walking to school and the stuff we used to see that way, right? But
what was it like being? Well, first of all, I'm gonna try to say your name, Nameka. Nameka.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, help me.
Nameka.
Nameka.
Egwekwe.
Egwekwe.
Yep.
A young man, third, fourth, fifth grade.
Yeah.
With this different name.
Yeah.
What was that like? I mean, I'm sure there's a mini story, a mini of messed up and jacked up pronunciations.
Well, that's true. I got all kinds of names. I mean, my last name is Egwekwe.
Right.
But it was Ego Waffles. It was Quakey. It was all kinds of things they
really?
Used to say, you know. It's something I think about a lot to this day, right? About the relationships between African Americans and Africans, right?
Yes.
And how we misunderstand each other and we believe what others have told us about each other, right?
Right.
Instead of figuring out ways to more cooperate. So mm-hmm. like, you know, some of the stereotypes that African Americans have about Africans, I can't tell you how many times I was called African booty scratcher, right? As a kid, right?
Yeah.
And those kinds of things, right?
Yeah.
Very common, right?
Right.
But at the same time, you
Where
know,
did booty scratching come from?
No idea, man. No idea.
I'm trying to figure out where did the booty scratching piece come from. But go ahead.
But that was a favorite thing, right?
Oh, okay.
And even my brother and I, you know, because my father wasn't there, right? We didn't have a clear understanding of what it was like to be an African, right? So we would respond.
So
like,
your brother's African as well.
Yeah, my brother and I.
So y'all have the same dad, is what I mean.
That's right. Yeah, same dad. And it wasn't until we were grown that we learned we had five sisters also, right?
Oh, man.
So we're all cool, right? That's a great story too.
So the sisters are here in America?
Yeah. Everyone's. So my brother and I were born in Chicago.
Okay.
And my sisters were all born in Chicago, but my mother, when my parents separated, didn't want to raise two boys in Chicago by herself. So that's why she came back home to Memphis to raise us.
Wow.
And then moved in with her mom, who was taking care of her mom. That's
right.
That's how I had so many generations in the house.
But you had 20. You said something like. You didn't meet your dad till you were 20-something years
old. I was 23,
years, 23 years old.
Yeah.
What was that moment like?
You know, man, that was.
Because you're grown at that point.
That's right. I just finished my master's degree, and a friend of mine was looking for me and found me, my brother, and some guy named Sonny And my mother had told me that my father went by the name Sonny sometimes, right? And so I asked my friend how he did that, and he showed me. And my brother and I sat on the information for like a year, right? But then, long story short.
Did y'all meet him together?
We did, yeah. So long story short, my brother was living in Ohio at the time.
Right.
He drove up to Chicago. I flew up to Chicago. I think I was living in Atlanta at the time.
Okay.
And we all met up at Midway Airport. And that's where I first met my father, at Midway Airport in Chicago.
How's your relationship today?
We have a great relationship today, right? I mean, it is, you know, so here's the thing, right? As a kid, because I had the same name as him, I'm a junior, right?
Right.
So I was, right? I mean, it is, you know, so here's the thing, right?